Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick flick that made us who we are. My name is Karen Benhu, I'm an author and a bass player who died in Vietnam. Joining me is writer and a man with eyes so blue they named contact lenses after him, Tom McInnes.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
Today we're talking about Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid. A book that I made you read.
Yes, you did. And I'm glad that you did, because it has opened a small but sort of, I think,
worthwhile. Small, very real door.
Yes.
So what happened was, you're one of my favourite people in the world to talk about books with. But you read like more fiction than any man I know, which I didn't think that men could do that anymore, because they don't.
We just like lost that power through lack of use.
Yeah. Exactly. Gavin, the man who lives in this house, reads one book a year, and it's mostly about whaling vessels. But you read all the fucking time, and you also read women. But what you don't read that often is women's commercial fiction or chick lit or whatever you want to call it, and what we do on this podcast. And so I wanted to have you on the podcast, but you hadn't really read anything that fit the brief. And so this book was like, it was the woman sun lounger book of last year. It's been requested on this podcast lots of times. And so I said, okay, you're into music. You write music. You're one of my favorite musical friends and favorite artists, I think, even though all your music exists on SoundCloud, is on a private link and is given only to me.
Which may have something to do with why you feel it speaks to you, because it literally does.
Yeah, it is like my OnlyFans of your brain. No nudity, all just similes about growing up in Bedford.
Just naked emotion.
Naked emotion, exactly. So what, like, given that this book was an assignment, what is your sort of broad take on it so far?
So, as you said, I don't, not only have I not really read much, I don't know, what term do we go with these days? Chick lit?
Chick lit or commercial women's fiction, yeah.
I'll go with commercial women's fiction.
Yeah.
I don't read much commercial women's fiction. In fact, I kind of avoided it, not because, just because I felt that, like, reading a book is actually a bit of an undertaking when there, or it's a bit of a commitment when there's so much less, there's so much easier stuff out there that you can fill your time with. So I always felt that, like, I wanted to maximize or like optimize my time by reading books that I felt had some kind of real cultural, intellectual cachet. You know, that bullshit.
Yeah. But what's interesting, though, is that, like, we've talked about this before, you have this sort of, like, conversion metric in your head where you will read, like, any old tosh by any man, as long as it's about, like, detectives and, like, people being murdered and found under bridges and stuff, and, like, detectives getting drunk together. If you're going to read a woman, she basically has to be a genius, or me.
Yeah, well, that's exactly... That's very true. Like, my two criteria generally for choosing a book are either, like, one, this is in the Western canon, I will read it, or two, the blurb talks about sparse,
muscular prose
that expose the brutal nature of the Old West, or gold prospecting, or whaling, or or the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles in the 1950s. I'm like,
oh. I could do with some of that more underbelly. I could shave off some of that belly. And that was definitely, I think, when we first became friends, like 10 years ago. That was the books that we were always talking about, was like Paris in the 20s, the great drunk men of the earlier 20th century. And I've gone on a bit of a journey with my reading, and this is me trying to take you on that journey with me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a brief plot summary of Daisy Jones and the Six. And I really do mean very brief, because I think a lot of this book is like in the personal sort of dynamics of the people. So I would just say that Daisy Jones and the Six is a fictional oral history about your favourite 70s rock band that never existed. While the main narrative focuses on the relationship between the two lead singers, Billy and Daisy Jones, the book is an encapsulation of life, drugs, partying, and art on the Sunset Strip in the 1970s. And that's all I really feel like I have to get into, because otherwise there's a real zoomed out version of this book you can talk about, which is like, it's about music in the 70s. But then once you kind of zoom in, it's like, in many ways, the plot can be quite tedious. It's like a lot of like, well, Daisy wanted to sing this, but I didn't want her to. And in the end, we found a compromise for about 150 pages in the middle.
Mm.
But so I saw you on your little memorandum of there, like assembling like a pros and cons list of this book. And I'd like to know what you think of the pros and cons.
Yes. So I think some things that immediately jumped out to me as positives was that courage, if that's the right word, to make the characters unlikable. And at least to me, they, especially the two leads, so Billy and Daisy, are most of the book, like they go from just being kind of irritating to hateful.
Yeah.
And I don't really think they have much. They're not really redeemed in any way. And I kind of like that. Like, because I do imagine that most people that made that made sort of soft rock in the 70s were probably a bit up themselves.
Yeah, just a bunch of cons, really.
Just a bunch of idiots. And I think that is kind of brought to life and reiterated again in sort of everything they say and do. And yeah, I can get behind that because I have a pretty bleak view of humanity as well. So, yeah. So what I think helps that is the fact that, and it sort of feeds into these kind of deeply flawed characters, is that the relationships are quite complex.
Mm-hmm.
And even like the sort of the romantic relationship is, I think, unconventional.
Yeah.
And I, obviously, as we've said, I don't really read much romantic.
Yeah.
Generally, if somebody, in the books that I usually read, if somebody has romantic feelings towards somebody else, that's just because they're going to die in 50 pages.
And you're kind of, and they're actually, you know, we do spoilers on this podcast. There is a death in this book, but I found it genuinely unexpected.
Yeah.
And I thought as well, the way this is formatted, this book was sort of like doing the rounds in all my kind of book recommending channels for a long time. And I avoided it like the fucking plague because of all the things I thought it was. And I was kind of right, but, and yet I really liked it anyway, because like the idea of like an oral history about a made up band is already an annoying idea. And like having read extracts, I was kind of like, oh God, it's sort of like the manic pixie dream rock star girl kind of thing. And this constant reiterating of this person's beauty and mystery. And I'm like, oh, do I really need that? But I think what I admired most about it from like a purely technical sense was like, the way that format is used in a way that's completely engaging and sort of trips along really, really quickly. And it does sort of burn past. And how what strikes me as well on the second read through is how much it absolutely wouldn't work if it was like a straightforward novel about like two rock stars who fell in love but ultimately couldn't be together. Like, because it is kind of a Romeo and Juliet story. And like, this thing of like, and you're totally right in that like they suck as people. They fucking suck. Like Daisy is just, she's so annoying. And like the sort of petulant child rock star thing of like, and all of her anecdotes. And I've met people like this, people who like are a little bit famous or who used to be famous or whatever. They have this way of framing all of their anecdotes, even though they claim to be completely like self-aware and have a 20/20 vision of their own past. And they've gotten sober and they do meditation now. It's like this thing where all of their anecdotes like end with them like swinging their handbag over their shoulder and being like, yeah, "Well, it's my way or it's nothing, Billy." And then they walked out and got a hamburger. Well, you
it's
know?
The older Alan Partridge thing. It's like, needless to say, I had the last laugh.
It is, and that's so true and so fitting, because it's like, but it's like when it's five different people or six different people, seven, saying all at once, Well, needless to say, I had the last laugh. It becomes quite interesting, and they're sort of competing narratives.
Yeah. It is overused in the book, I think. Like, the first couple of times, I'd say the first several times, that there was that thing where it's like, and that's how it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that.
Yeah,
I was like, ha! And
then, what a guess!
And then, like, after, like, 50 times, I was like...
Yeah, no, and I completely know what you mean as well, because, like, the first time where it's like... when they land on the band name, The Six, and it's like six competing narratives of like who came up with the name.
Yeah.
One guy likes it because it sounded like The Sex. Karen likes it because she said to somebody on the phone, oh, there's six of us, and then they thought it was called The Six. It was like everyone doing their own apocryphal thing.
Yeah.
Which, well, the first time happens, it's so effective, and then after a while you're like, yeah, man.
Yeah.
Find a new idea.
But it's interesting that you say that it wouldn't work without it being this kind of oral, what did we decide it was called?
Oral history.
Oral history. Because I do also think that it being an oral history hinders it as literature.
Okay, go on.
Well, because there's no sort of active conflict. Everything is happening sort of in retrospect. There's no, it's like... Like, a couple of times, I was thinking, like, shit, Daisy's gonna die. And then I remembered, oh no, Daisy's telling me the fucking story.
Yeah, this is like a Beyond the Grave scenario.
Which, I mean, can work.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard.
There you go.
Yeah. Let's get as many sort of...
Another great Sunset Strip sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. There's also this, like, it's all... And this is gonna seem more negative than I think it is, but it's all show... Sorry, it's all tell.
Yeah.
No show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because and that is literally, it's set up as the function of the entire narrative, isn't it? And like,
mm-hmm.
is that this is all tell and no show. I think there is like, where is my copy of the book gone?
Oh, they're all here.
They're all here, our piles of books.
Our piles of Daisy Jones.
And this is, like, it begins, it begins with an author's note, which is, of course, a fictional author's note. It's not from Taylor Jenkins Reid. It's from the fictional author of this oral history, his compiler. And I've just edited it with this.
I love this kind of shit.
Which is, I do love this kind of shit. It's like, okay, so it begins with, this book is an attempt to piece together a clear portrait of how the renowned 1970s rock band, Daisy Jones and the Six, rose to fame, as well as what led to their abrupt and infamous split while on tour in Chicago on July 12th, 1975. Over the course of the last 8 years, I've conducted individual interviews, blah, 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 blah. And she goes on to say that, you know, there are competing narratives and different events will read differently to different people. And then she says, she ends with, the truth often lies unclaimed in the middle. Which I think is a really, like... from the beginning, I'm like, oh shit, I'm in. I am so in.
Yeah.
I love that kind of stuff. I love the sort of like the sort of construction of like who is the author of this text kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something you touched upon in your previous podcast around Virgin Suicides, which I really responded to as well. Yeah, it's that thing to create kind of like. Different levels of fiction, like Russian dolls.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's like this thing of like these that were. It's telling you that this is a book filled with unreliable narrators, but then you have that immediate thing of being like, well, who's this unreliable narrator?
It's an interesting point actually, because that was another thing that it's. I think I kind of had it in my negatives column, but this idea of authorial voice, which there isn't really one, right? Like, and I think. I was trying to think about like what do I really respond to, what do I really love specifically about novels is the fact that somebody that I'm in somebody's hands and it's usually somebody that I trust or someone who I'm learning to trust. And I'm talking about the author, not necessarily like I know I trust Philip Roth to take me on a journey or whatever.
Even that journey is wanking in a cabin somewhere, thinking about Anne Frank.
That's generally where the journey leads, and I'm comfortable there.
I know, I like it.
I've visited many times. In fiction. But I guess the nature of it being being this oral history means that, that you don't really feel any kind... Well, there isn't one narrator. There isn't one... There isn't really an authorial voice, is there?
No. But, like, I think it is what... As I said before, what makes it, like, less of a fucking grind of, like, these two... As we said, these two people, Billy and Daisy. Like, the thing of Daisy is, like, the child of a model and an artist. And, and Billy was this handsome sort of Mick Jagger type, and he had it, and they both had it, and nobody knows what it is.
Yeah.
But what I really responded to then was that, like, there is a sort of a high velocity romance, creative collaboration going on with these two characters. But then there's these like tiny other relationships happening that feel really important and really flesh the book out. Like this, there's a sort of like a mirror romance happening with Karen, who's the keyboardist, and Graham.
Graham.
Yeah. With Graham.
Graham?
I always forget that when you're reading an American book and someone's called Graham, it's called Graham.
Which sounds stupid, but it's actually better than fucking Graham. Graham.
Which sounds like...
Graham.
Like a mining town. Yeah,
like, Graham, you spilt beans all over the floor.
Graham. Me and Graham are in love. Yeah, so yeah. Karen and Graham are having this sort of relationship, like, sort of threaded throughout. And that feels like a much more compelling love story because they're two much more low-key characters. And they're sort of having the secret romance. It's not even really secret, but it's more secret because nobody really gives a fuck about them because they're not the main characters.
Yeah.
And there's all these kind of stories about them sort of like in Laurel Canyon just taking shrooms and having a great time together.
Yeah, I love that shit.
Yeah.
And I would say more of that, but actually no, that's the right amount. It's got the right amount.
Good right amount of Karen and Graham.
Well, the whole thing, that's a big plus for me is that it does feel real, like scary degree. Like, literally, like, 6 times I went to YouTube or Spotify to see and try and listen to this song that they're talking about. And then, again, remembering, oh, some fucker made it up.
Some woman made it up. and because it is that thing where it's, like, that lovely thing that everyone loves, even if it is corny, that thing, the sort of Forrest Gump effect, right? Of, like, oh, we're going to mesh in pretend characters with real characters.
I can't get enough of it.
So good. Why is it so good?
I don't know, but my God.
Yeah. My God, I love it. Like, even, I don't know, and why, so it just tickles a part of my brain that is so childish and stupid.
Yeah.
Especially when, at the very beginning, there's this bit where it's like the concierge of, like, the Marriott that's, like, on Sunset Strip in the 70s. They interview him to see if he remembers the bands coming through, and he sort of talks about meeting Daisy, about meeting other people.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because that Marriott exists.
Yeah. And he was like, ooh, Robert Plant was here, and I was like, oh, start wanking now.
It's so good. I'm like, I read somewhere that Taylor Jenkins Reid, who as a career author, fascinates me anyway, because she's somebody who started with very conventional romance and has pivoted in the last few years on, like, her 5th and 6th books to doing these kind of novels. Like, her kind of twin novel to this is called The 7 Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, which is kind of, it was very, very, it's like an Elizabeth Taylor story version of this. It's not an oral history, but it has a kind of, like, we're gonna present you with a fictional entertainment history that feels close enough to something real that you believe it, kind of thing. But so I'm interested in her. But apparently her research for this was just ordering every fucking copy of Rolling Stone off eBay in, like, big chunks from that period.
Yeah,
which sounds fun.
Yeah, no, I think I read that or saw that video as well. And she also mentions that another major influence on her was the biography of Bruce Springsteen.
Which you've definitely read.
Which, of course, I read when it came out. And I'll tell you something about it. I didn't love it.
Oh, no.
But I can absolutely see the influence of it on the character of Billy, who is a fucking drag.
Yeah, he is a drag.
He is a drag.
Yeah.
So the influence of the Bruce Springsteen biography is thus. I was reading the Bruce Springsteen biography, and I was getting along with it pretty well. I mean,
what was it called? Was it called, like, The Boss Rides a Horse or something?
I think it was called Born to Run.
Oh my God, of course. I love Bruce Springsteen, but that man loves that his name is the boss.
Oh my god. Well, who wouldn't?
Caroline,
if they were going around calling you the boss, it's like, oh, the boss is coming. the boss is coming to brunch. Yeah. That's the boss walking her dog. Oh, she's picking up its shit.
I retract that. I do not hold Bruce Springsteen accountable for loving being called the boss. Because I too would love to be called the boss.
So I'm reading the Bruce Springsteen autobiography and I'm getting along with it pretty well. He's writing some great songs that I also love. It's fantastic. And he's really starting to enjoy, and him and the whole E Street Band are really starting to enjoy their fame. Mm-hmm. And it comes at this point in the book where he writes, you know,
oh no!
A lot of people in this industry, they have a problem with drugs and alcohol. Not me, though! And at that stage, I had like 400 pages of this fucking thing left, and I basically tossed it across the room.
Was it because you hated that Bruce Springsteen was lying to you, or you hated that Bruce Springsteen was a square?
No, it's that. It's like, I'm reading a rock and roll biography, and you've just telegraphed on page 80 of 560 that you had no substance abuse problems at any point. Like, what the fuck is the rest of the book going to be filled with?
So it's like, either you're lying and you think I'm a child, or you're a child. You went through that long a career and you never had a substance abuse problem?
500 pages of like, oh, I went from strength to strength. And this is, I've gone now real like Southern Baptist now with Bruce Springsteen, who was born in New Jersey.
Famously.
Yeah. He's like, oh yeah, like we just went from strength to strength, everything was great, and I played the Super Bowl, and I love my wife, and love my kids, and that's me.
That's all I have to say about that. Yeah,
needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Then he said to someone, well, it's my song, or it's no one, and he swung his hand back over his shoulder, and he walked out. I very enjoyed that.
Yeah, but...
Visit from the boss.
But that's Billy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except Billy has a dark side.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes that comes to the fore at certain points. There's like a great scene towards the end. So I assume people who are listening to this will have read the book.
Yeah, mostly. Yeah.
Okay, so Billy's like a recovering alcoholic and coke and heroin addict.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of goes back and forth throughout the book. Well, he's basically struggling with his sobriety for the whole time. And towards the very end of the book, he actually has a drink. It's a fucking great scene. It's like probably it's my second favourite in the scene after the one that I'm going to talk about now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where he goes to pick up Daisy from a party at her house, and she's like completely fucked up on coke and pills and alcohol and things like that, and she's in this stunning dress and like floating in a swimming pool, and there's this great description of her from her like best friend stroke minder
Simone, who's like a disco star.
And the quote is something like, she's going to be the girl bleeding in a beautiful dress until it kills her. Which is just a fantastic line. It feels like something that I think anyone who's ever dabbled in, any boy especially, I think, who's ever dabbled in teenage poetry or sort of emo songwriting has written a version of that line at some point.
You've got about 6 million songs that are some version of
that. Basically.
Some word salad of that statement.
Absolutely. But while Simone is thinking that, Billy is thinking... It is watching from the sidelines and thinking something else. Shall I read a passage?
Oh, please do. I would love that.
So I'm going to jump around like these two pages, 181 and 182, for anyone reading along.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with him just describing being at the party, and he just says, there was a guy next to me, some guy I would have told you was an old geezer, except he was probably only 40. I could smell the whiskey in his glass, that smoky antiseptic scent. It's always been the smell for me. The smell of tequila, the smell of beer, even coke. The smell of anything of it. It takes me right back to those moments when the night is just starting, when you know you're going to get into trouble. It feels so good, the beginning. And then he goes on to say, as he's watching Daisy, who, as we've said, is drenched in this beautiful dress. She's stepped in broken glass, and there's blood dripping into the pool. And
she never wears shoes.
Yeah, and she's a complete mess. And Simone says that she's always going to be that girl bleeding in the beautiful dress until it kills her. And literally the very next line is Billy's, and it just says, "I couldn't stay. I couldn't stay because when I looked at Daisy, wet and bleeding and out of it, and half near falling down, I did not think, thank God I stopped using. I thought, she knows how to have fun."
It's very good.
And late,
it's the most like telling piece of like, this character speaks hundreds of lines of dialogue in this book, and it's the most like, oh, that's who he is.
Yeah.
It's that moment.
And he kind of crystallizes it on the next page where he just says, "My instinct said to run towards chaos." Yes. And I think that's it. I think it's like, whenever you, so much of when we talk about people who have like substance abuse issues and things like that, it's like you see them destroying their lives and you go, oh my God, why would you still...
I would simply not destroy my life.
Why would you still do it? And you're like, that's the point.
Yeah.
Like it's... and there's a line that's something like this in the book, which is like, some people chase nightmares like others chase dreams. And I think... Yeah, I think it's just, it's very true and very... realistic and very believable that the compulsion to do these things and the self-destructive impulse is that, and it is to create chaos in your life for whatever reason. I think maybe because you feel like you lack meaning, or you lack, I'm not a psychologist, and I feel this way every single time I see like any story of like, you know, somebody going off the edge or going crazy and like destroying their lives.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be related to drugs or anything. I'm just like, oh yeah.
Ah, yes.
No, yeah, you know, it's like, and I feel like kind of like a relatively, I would say very sort of stable life myself. I've had the same job for 10 years.
Mm.
I've, you know, all this stuff deliberately, but like, I just kind of, My fantasy is about burning it down.
What is that, do you think? Because I think that is like a little seed that lives in people that I know but who aren't me, and I'm constantly trying to understand.
I don't know. I think it's definitely related to a thing that, you know, I don't know. I think I assume that everyone had this, but you can tell me otherwise. That thing of, it's actually become a cliche now, but going towards the edge of the cliff and being like, jump.
Yeah.
Like you just want to jump. Like, I always had that. Like, I used to just, I always relate it back to this memory I had when I was a kid, when we were just driving at like 100 miles an hour down the motorway, and I was in the back of my whole family in a car driving back to my grandparents or something, and I just like, opened the door.
Yeah, just to see.
Just to see what would happen. All right, I knew it was going to be bad. Yeah. That was the thing. And you know, you remember those things where you like do things and you know this is going to be, this is going to be bad.
Mm.
I think it's just a bit of that. And it's like, you want badness. You want to invite chaos and badness into your life. And when she writes about that in the book, it feels not just like real and not just insightful, but like really worthwhile. Like those were the points where I was like, I'm glad I'm reading this. Like, I'm getting some insight into myself.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm getting some insight into people in general, which relates back to, I think, to what we were talking about how I choose books generally and why I generally avoid commercial, I don't want to say commercial women's fiction, commercial fiction.
Yeah,
I think,
fair enough.
Generally is because, to me, if I'm going to spend like a week or 2 weeks reading a book, at the end of it, I want it to have contributed to my big project, which is
your life,
my understanding of myself and why I do these things that I do, and why I've made the choices that I've made, and why and what I'm going to do about it, and how I'm going to become better over time. And I think I felt I had this perception that a lot of commercial women's fiction was kind of about like self-empowerment or sort of affirmation. And I don't really have much time for affirmation because I think most people actually need to really look at themselves and get better. I don't think people are, I mean, and I know maybe I'm completely wrong. Most people, I don't think they are fine as they are at all. Wow. I think people have massive flaws that they could work on if they were critical of them, really. And I don't mean critical about sort of superficial things, I think.
But I think you're quite, you reject a sort of any sense of coziness in art because I think, and a lot of people subscribe to this thing of like, that work should always be challenging you or making you ask questions of yourself and asking you to get better. And I do think that women's commercial fiction is absolutely capable of doing that, the same as any other genre, the same as fantasy does, the same as sci-fi does or whatever. It's just it tends to be wrapped in different packaging. Mm. But I do think you have sort of given me an insight there, because I think I've said a lot on this podcast, why won't men read these books? Like, I always use the example of, like, Jilly Cooper's Riders as being a book that is, like, it's a David and Goliath story about two men, like, fighting it out through the international show jumping circuit. It couldn't be more masculine. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think I could find a man in a million who's read it, you know?
Yeah.
But maybe it is this thing of, like, we are all just reading to improve this great project that is our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's couched in this kind of female desire thing, like, what are men going to get from that, you know? Maybe I don't know, maybe that is a more charitable reading, because I've just been calling it misogyny, so and that's fine too.
Yeah.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
I really loved the bits in, or when, like, Daisy sort of, like, making it as a bit of, like, a professional it girl. She's kind of everybody's girlfriend. She never wears shoes, which is, like, one of these details that feel, like, to go back to the scene that you just read from, that feels quite, like, practiced and annoying when it first comes up, because Daisy is sort of practiced and annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you realise, when she sort of, like, well, it occurs to me rereading that scene and rehearing it from you, she's not wearing shoes, she's stepped in glass, she's sort of broken blood everywhere, where it's like, oh, this character quirk has become your character fault, kind of thing. It's a visual representation of that. Like, she's literally not wearing shoes in any spiritual or emotional sense. But there's this bit where Daisy has been signed to, like, a label based on the strength of, like, two performances of Son of a Preacher Man and the fact that she's in magazines a lot, and they want her to be sort of the next Olivia Newton-John, and they want her to, like, cover existing songs in their catalogue, and she sort of, like, walks out, is completely entitled about the whole thing, says she wants to perform her songs, has no musical training or chops or credibility whatsoever. And there's this moment where one of the characters is the manager, Teddy, who's interesting character in the book, but says to her, a person who requires the ideal conditions to make art is not an artist, they are an asshole. I underlined it, like, very hard, like, dig through the paper hard. I feel like I need to write it down somewhere public. But
it could be like your live, laugh, love.
It really could be. And I really liked the whole thing of people making art in this book, and it being this combination of being quite a romantic thing. It's like, oh, we were all in the studio taking drugs and then someone came up with a riff, and then like mixed with the sort of like the hard graft of coming up with things, of doing stuff, of doing the work, of working all night, and then also of like having to work with people who have their own vision.
I think that's the best stuff in the book.
Yeah,
I really, really do. All of the stuff, and I love how in-depth it is, and how much time is spent on it. The creation of the like right down to like the sequencing of songs on the album, yeah. Which is something I'm really into. Like, I don't know, like the whole, like, you can't offend me more than telling me that you listen to one of my favorite albums on shuffle. It's like, you like what you're gonna do? You're gonna watch like the last scene of Goodfellas first, and then you're gonna watch like the bit where Karen does the thing. You know, it's like, that's crazy to me that people would listen to albums on shuffle.
Yeah,
I think sequencing is so important, and I'm really glad that Billy and Taylor feel the same. Because, yeah, so I did feel like I wasn't in the presence of someone who was a tourist in this world.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's clear that the writer cares deeply about what she's writing about, and it cares about the stuff that is actually really interesting about it. This is not just the like 70s music scene isn't just a backdrop for a romance.
Completely.
No,
yeah.
Like, if anything, the romance is secondary.
That's really interesting, actually. Yeah, and like, and because this book has been sort of had this huge life as like this big Sun Lounger book, you would think that it would be a bit of a like a 70s shag carpet fuckfest, right? But it's actually not. It's so technical. It's so niche and detailed, and like spends a lot of time on like songs we're never gonna fucking hear.
Well, she writes the whole album at the back of the book. Because that's what it's really about. I almost feel like I almost feel like the romance is the kind of afterthought. It's like, oh, I'm writing this Sun Lounger book. There better be some fucking in it.
Yeah. Totally. And like, I think, and just the whole thing of we've heard so many different times about great bands who get together and they split up, and it's always these things like, oh well, you know, Paul wanted to write the songs the same as John, or George did, or I don't know, you're much more of a Beatles person than I am. It's always something that to people from the outside feels eminently solvable. And then when the band who are now in their 70s go, yeah, well, he wanted to do this and I wanted to do this, and so we didn't talk for 3 years. You're like, what? Like, you had a fucking number one album. What are you talking about? But this has like such a realistic, you're like, oh, that's how it happens.
Mm.
The slow building tension, especially from the kind of periphery band members like Eddie and Warren, who are like, no, they're not the main characters and are both comfortable and not comfortable with it. Like, there's this bit where they talk about their big gig where they bring on Daisy for the first time, and it's their first sort of like assemblage as this new unit. And it's like, oh, you know, and Billy takes the acoustic guitar away from Eddie, and then they sit on the stage and they're singing into the same mic, and it's very Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, and everyone loves it, and it's this iconic moment in music history. And Eddie, meanwhile, is like, 50 years later, so like, he took my guitar. He didn't ask, he took it, and then he didn't give it back to me, and I had to pack up my own stuff. What kind of shit is that?
Yeah.
And I was like, really? I was like, yeah, Eddie, what kind of shit is that? Like, I thought that made, like, it really peeled back this layer of like, oh, look, these kind of, the beautiful people whose foreheads are almost touching as they sing in the same mic, and it really peels back to like, well, what does the guitar player think? What does the bass player think? You know?
Yeah.
Because these are the people we don't hear from in musical biopics and stuff.
Yeah. And I think spending time, especially though with Billy and Daisy, writing this, because you do hear in those old sort of like VH1 behind the music type things, like, oh, he wanted this and she wanted that, and that's why we didn't speak forever, and that's why the band broke up. But because you also get their personal lives in this book, you kind of see what the creation of this art means to them, which is very different.
Yes, that's really, really good. Yeah.
So for Daisy, being able to write her own songs is really about like as it sets up right at the beginning, you know, she's always being she is highly valued, but on other people's terms, because it's like, oh, because she's beautiful, or she's, you know, talented, or, you know, she's rich, white, and gorgeous, and all these things, and obviously she it's all for her. It's all about being valued on her own terms, whereas Billy needs to. Billy's addiction is his wife and his kids. As he just replaces one thing with the other.
Yeah.
And this is and him writing those songs about his wife over and over again, even though everyone else is so bored of them. That's like him going to, you know, that's like him going to AA. That's like him going through his going through his rituals and his routines to stay sober. Like I that's at least how I read it. And so this is literally, so though they're talking, they're arguing over how a song should be, they're really arguing over it's like, I have to do this for either my self-actualization, or I have to do this to fucking keep my life together. Like, that's kind of, I think, built into, like, in the subtext of the kind of the writing of each song, and that's why I think there is kind of drama there, and it does feel real. And I'm sure that is realistic to the way that people really. Well, sorry, I kind of know just from writing
you,
things.
You, it's like write collaboratively all the time. So you work in your day job in advertising. You have a creative partner, and you also are a screenwriter where you have a creative partner. Yeah. Like, you and I have written stuff together in the past, and like, you are a very like, you, your life is these relationships.
Well, it is, and it's like when you're screaming about sort of where. I mean, hopefully you're not screaming anymore, but it's like when you're arguing or storming out of a room or acting completely out of character about sort of where a word should be or what something should be. And, you know, of course, it's never about that. It's because of, you know, this sounds so pat, but it's like of what that represents. It's like, why do I need to have my way on this thing?
Yeah, yeah. Totally. And I think as well, that is the thing of like this album that goes on to be this smash hit, this album Aurora, and it means such different things to both of them, as you just outlined. It is this thing as well where there are two people in a room creating this thing together that means entirely separate things to them, and have entirely different iterations on what these words mean and who they mean what to. And they also have this thing of like this added layer of drama where it's Daisy, but it's, I say drama, but it's completely natural drama of Daisy represents the rock and roll lifestyle that Billy feels like he possibly should be leading, but knows he can't lead because, as you say, he's addicted to his wife and kids. Only you would phrase it that way. You're addicted to your wife. And there's this thing of like, they, like when he just gets out of rehab and he's trying to be like the good man. And there's this great part where like it's sort of this thing where he's holding it over his own head for the rest of his life, really, is he was so fucked up when his first child, Julia, was born that he missed her birth and then had to go to rehab and didn't meet her until she was 2 months old.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it's a huge thing for us to find out about our romantic hero, because it's like very hard to come back from that.
Mm.
And then it's this note that his wife Camilla gives him, which is, you have until November 30th to be the best man for the rest of your life or something. And it's this idea that someone can get sober for someone else, which I don't know if that's real. Do you think it is?
I think it's what someone else represents, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
More, I think a vision of a better life or a better way of being can be crystallized in one person. Like, if you know
what I mean. Yes, it's very that, yeah.
Know what I mean? So I think he sees in, isn't it?
Camilla.
I always call her Camille. Camilla.
Oh, maybe it is. I don't know. We're all just reading.
Yeah. We're all just readers floating in infinite space on a planet that's gonna heading to oblivion. Camilla.
Or Camille.
Or Camille.
Your reading is as valid as mine.
Camilla. Camilla is the face of his alternative life.
Mm.
So I think that's it. I don't think she is as powerful as he makes her.
Yes.
That's why it's like, oh, I love my wife so much. It's like, don't fuck your wife.
Then. I know. I know, and you're really there with the rest of the band being like, why don't you go and fuck your wife somewhere and leave us all alone? Yeah.
But it's not actually about her, is it? It's about what she's the opposite of oblivion, you know, disrepute, disrepair, death, etc. So it's more just like she's. Yeah, that's one thing we haven't touched on as well, which is touched on several times in the book, which is, and again, maybe it's a little bit of a cliche, but Billy and his brother have like a deadbeat dad.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So.
See, as a male reader, I think that you would zero in on that much more than
I would. Oh, no, totally. That's like a freaking.
numero uno, yeah. Big theme on campus.
Yeah.
Where I'll just like flick over and
I see
like,
dad, I have to immediately squeeze a tear back into my duct.
Someone's got a dad.
Yeah, I know. I was like, dad, now we're starting.
Oh, dad's here.
Come on, dad.
yes, and they've deadbeat dad, and who they see again at this wedding they play, and Camilla is at the same wedding.
Yeah. Yes, I didn't remember that bit.
Yeah, well. It's...
But dad.
You said you had some stuff to say about 70s rock. In the book.
Well, yes, I do, Caroline. 70s rock, not the best era for rock.
Do you not think so?
I would say. I think, okay, so I have a kind of, I wouldn't call it a theory because I've only sort of created it for the purposes of this podcast. But
all my theories are for this podcast.
You can basically judge where rock music is at by where Bob Dylan is at that time. So, for example...
I love this. Go on.
60s. So, 1965. I mean, you don't have to make a very strong argument to say that's the best, the greatest year for rock and roll. Whatever. That's the banner year for rock and roll. I don't want to fuck this up now and sort of say something's wrong. But it's around that time that you're getting your Sgt. Pepper's and everything. And obviously, and Bob Dylan has shed the kind of original vagabond... look and feel, and he sort of bursts out onto the Newport folk festival stage with the glasses and the big hair and the leather jacket
the scene jeans. From Walkout.
Yes, we all do. And so that's when it's at its best. And then in the 70s, he has this motorcycle accident in the late 60s, and he basically goes into hiding and just becomes a dad with a beard and some little...
And John Lennon did a similar thing, right? He hid and was a dad with a beard for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I hate John Lennon. I hate him when he's good, I hate him when he's bad, I hate John Lennon.
Wow.
And I'm glad he's dead.
Wow.
This ain't about John Lennon.
No, this is about Bob Dylan. Crucially.
I ain't talking about motherfucking John Lennon.
Other man in music.
Yeah.
They're all into.
Yeah, he's got the glasses, he's got the beard, he's wearing fucking jackets with patches on the sleeves, and that is what the 70s rock scene is. It's a bit too comfortable, it's a bit too... It's like, they may be having a crazy time sort of behind the scenes, but I think the music becomes kind of a little bit... it's not dangerous anymore.
Mm.
And I listen to the album Rumours in preparation for this podcast.
Yes, I think Fleetwood Mac is definitely the closest thing to this, right? Yeah. It's the most obvious... Yeah. Parallel.
I don't like it.
You don't like Rumours?
No, for that exact reason. I'm just like, I don't feel, even though I know all the stories behind it, I feel like there's nothing at stake in this music. And the fact that this is the music that these guys are writing, again, that was something that was working against me. I was like, you're arguing over this shit, but I know you're just going to make some pop rock track that I would never listen to.
Wow. Okay, so are you on the same side as like the bass player and the drummer, who are basically like throughout the book being like, we thought we were a rock band.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and then and like then when they get Daisy on, and when Karen starts doing more keys, they're like, hey guys,
we
signed up to be in a rock band.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. But my Dylan theory, by the way, which I'm sort of developing as I'm speaking, it really works, because if you look at the '80s Dylan, he's kind of a bit. booze bloated. He's got an earring in that doesn't really suit him at all. He's got the lines under his eyes, and he's got a kind of leather jacket, and it's got studs on it. And it's like, this is like, yeah, this is just this like bloated plastic wreck of rock and roll. And then he comes back. This is now a Dylan podcast. I'm taking over.
Dylan, a man who I know almost nothing about, okay, but I love being educated.
Yeah. Oh, and anyway, where he comes back in the 90s and he does this kind of like slightly grungy blues rock thing, which really represents where rock was going, and it's all good, and it gets back to its roots for a little bit.
And so what's Bob Dylan doing right now?
He released an album, about 6 months ago. It was fantastic. It's basically his farewell album. It's got some lines in it that you would go absolutely mad for, just as someone who likes kind of the legend of writers and of creators and things like that. And somebody at 80 looking back on their life. In fact, we don't have to keep this in, but I'm just going to tell you.
Okay.
So the last proper track on the album, there's like a bonus track that's 17 minutes long, of course it is. But the last verse of the last track on the album, he just goes, "When I was 12 years old, they put me in a suit, forced me to marry a prostitute." And that's the music industry, isn't it?
Yeah. Is that what that is?
And then he's like, "That's my story, but not where it ends. She's still cute and we're still friends."
Oh, I do like that. Yeah.
And I just like...
You know what? You started and I hated it, but now I like it. Weird how that happened.
Yeah, I know. And every single time I hear it, and I've heard it like 1,000 times now, I just like...
Oh, wow.
Because he's singing like his last message to the thing. It's like, and it's like...
She's still cute and we're still friends.
Music, right? I'm 80 years old, but I'm putting out one final album and this is how I feel about it and you're listening to it.
Wow.
That's my story, but not where it ends. She's still cute, and we're still friends.
That is really good.
Yeah. Well, Bob Dylan, quite good.
Bob Dylan, turns out, a lot of potential.
Yeah, okay. Anyway.
A lot of potential in that old, old man.
Yeah.
What did you think about the twist?
I thought it was lame and unearned.
Identify what the twist was for our readers.
Okay, so if you're referring to the same twist that I think you are, if one could even call it a twist, it's like the author who has not been remotely present throughout the entire narrative, quote-unquote narrative, suddenly reveals herself to be the daughter of Billy and Camille.
Yes, Julia, who is the baby whose birth he missed to be in rehab, yes?
Yes, yeah. That's not a twist because that character didn't exist in the in the novel.
Maybe it's not a twist. It is a stunt.
It's a stunt, but it's just like a stunt where everyone's looking in the other direction. It's like, Mum, Dad, look at me. It's like, it's like we're all sitting over here, like,
yeah, we're all thinking about Aurora and what it meant to us.
Yeah, watching somebody else, and it's like, I forgot you even exist. I didn't even know you exist.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Terry Jenkins Reid does a similar thing in that other kind of book, Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, of sort of revealing who the author is and what their place is in this narrative. And I think it is really interesting and admirable and like... I think the purpose of doing something like that, this sort of like... third act reveal of like, and you know, it was the author twisting the idea of this author. It only works if you're, this is my big theory of novels, is novels only work when you go into something with a big question and you come back out with 100 little questions.
Interesting.
And I think novels are only successful when that happens and when you can feel that someone has gone really, really, really deep into something and they have so much more questions than they thought they were going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why issuesy novels don't work for anyone, because it's like, oh, well, this person went into it knowing exactly what they thought.
Yeah, that's great.
Whereas, so revealing that Julia is the kind of author would have been really interesting and exciting if on a reread you could see... oh, the placement of these quotes, the selection of these things, the omission of material makes it make total sense and gives it a complete new layer.
I think you're so right.
That we saw that Julia was the writer the whole time.
It's an answer to a question that no one was asking.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And I appreciate it for its narrative neatness, but so I read this, you know, maybe 7 months ago, and now I've reread it quickly today, hoping to find that extra layer of sort of Julia-ness mm-hmm. in it, and it's just kind of not there.
Oh, and also, it wouldn't be right for it to be there, because those, you know, these rock and roll oral histories never have a face behind them.
Yeah,
it's like, nobody cares who's making VH1 behind the music. I mean, even when it's like the Rolling Thunder review, which is the movie for the Bob... Back to Bob. The Bob Dylan movie for Netflix that Martin Scorsese did. Even Martin Scorsese is not present or relevant in that film at all. So it's like, it's not a thing.
Yeah, it's not a thing.
It's not a thing. Suddenly be like, oh shit, and the person behind the camera the whole time was...
I'm trying to think any place that's been effective. Or whether someone's tried it somewhere before and...
In terms of what? Suddenly revealing who the narrator is. Relieving the author.
It's kind of very... Oh my God, do you remember that... horrible adaptation of The Great Gatsby.
I try not to, but I still can. I can still see it.
I think you and I saw it together.
In the Rio?
In Dalston, yeah, we did. It was a big event for us.
Yeah, that motherfucker was like 8 years ago, 7 years ago. Yeah,
it was a while ago. And there's this bit where like Tobey Maguire's Nick Carraway character is in an asylum, and he's like talking to his therapist, and he's sort of like. And then he has his, like, his manuscript thing, and then he goes, Gatsby. And then he like goes, adds, The Great Gatsby. And you're like, oh, no!
No, you didn't!
Please don't do that!
Yeah.
Yeah, no, awful. Awful and bad. It's a real kind of ideas, like, uncanny valley, isn't it? It's like...
Yeah.
Oh, it's just not good when it happens.
No, I actually thought this was... I must have blanked it from my memory. I'm glad you brought it up, because I thought that this was actually one of the worst examples of that I've...
Yeah, oh, I feel bad now.
See, no, because I wouldn't have even mentioned that.
Oh.
Yeah, I would... because it's just the epitome of an unearned thing. Like, you thought you could get away with sort of making us go, ooh.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go ooh about something I wasn't going about earlier.
I think the purpose of it, in terms of like, and this is where I think, we were saying earlier on about how it's amazing that this was like a big Sunlander book, because it's so technical, it's so like nuanced and detailed about the creation of art, the creation of music, musicality, in a way that should not play with a sort of a mainstream holiday audience, right? But I think the place where you see like, oh, this is a Sunlander book, is the purpose of Julia being the compiler of this oral history is that it's revealed that Camilla is dead.
Yeah.
And died shortly after these interviews were taken. And there's a sort of like note from Camilla at the end being like, you know, your father should give Daisy Jones a call. And we're supposed to sort of believe that like, these two sort of 70-year-olds who now have lived entirely different lives for many years and really only spent 3 years together in the 70s are supposed to now, like, look each other up and fall in love and, like, open a ranch together. You know, it's just a bit... I can see how it worked for an audience who is not me.
Yeah. And there is also... Actually, it's interesting that you brought that up, because there's another thing where it's like... Because, as you say, it gets so much right. And is so clearly committed to this idea of the legend and the mythology of music creation and the creation of art. I struggle to believe that a band that put out two albums and one of them was a hit and then broke up would ever be... people would still give a shit about.
I mean, people still give a shit about the Libertines, so...
Yeah, but the Libertines weren't in the... Weren't 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it's just like there are plenty of bands out there who had like a hit album.
Yeah.
Like who listens to like Creedence Clearwater?
Lots of people.
Okay, well, fuck me, right? I'll shove that one up my ass.
I remember when I was researching this, I looked at the Goodreads reviews for this, which are mostly extremely positive, but there was one one-star review. I love those one flag waving.
Oh, I look for them. What's the... Who had the most shit to say?
Yeah, completely. And it's such, a one-star review is so much better than like a two-star review, because a two-star review is like, oh, I had some serious problems with this narrative. Yeah. But a one-star review is like, I barely engaged at all, but I'm mad. It's like just a man honking his horn. It means just slamming his fist down. And he said, I assume it was a he. I don't understand why this book needed to be written when there are so many existing bands with more interesting histories.
It's a fair point.
It's like he's an idiot, but it's a fair point.
But I think we may have kind of got to the bottom of like that when we talk about when we were speaking earlier about them bringing different things into the writing room. I think that's where it starts to be really interesting, because it starts to become about the different ways people use art and the creation of art to you know, sort out their own personal demons and their own things that they need to do, and what happens when that kind of thing collides, when one person's journey collides with another.
Yeah, you're totally right.
I don't think you could get that any other way, really.
Yeah, because I don't think you could get this from a musical documentary about an existing figure kind of thing, because nobody has this level of clarity, I think.
And they wouldn't reveal that shit. That's where it like breaks with reality, because I mean, I don't know why I'm picking on him. Tom Petty's not going to reveal... He was making music at that time.
You leave Tom alone. Yeah.
Tom Petty's not going to reveal what was going on with his wife on fucking VH1.
You're so right. That is exactly where it captures a reality in a way that only fantasy can.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's... you're right. Yeah, there is no living rock star who's going to just be sounding off about how they had this like unbelievable sexual chemistry, but that was totally unfulfilled with their nightmare of a lead singer. You know, it's just not going to happen. But yeah, this is something we've said quite a few times in this podcast now, but it's like Daisy and the Jones.
No, I think you're right. I think that is what it's called. Let's not check.
Daisy and the Jones. Daisy Jones and the Six.
She joined and it was just the Jones.
Convenient.
Like, I mean...
just, you know, that's why we knew we had to have her in the band.
Yeah.
Daisy Jones and the Six are not a real rock band. But what they tell us about real rock bands is real. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very well put, very well summarised.
Thank you, it took me a few goes,
yeah,
but I got there.
Great. So, this has been Sentimental Garbage.
I'm Caroline
Donoghue.
This feels like a natural end. Yes, you go, you do it.
Okay. I'm Caroline Donoghue, I'm a writer, podcaster, and I'm the grit that exists in the tray of a toaster that you really should have replaced 6 months ago.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Did I get it right? Yeah.
You did. That is exactly how the order I like that to go. Thank you. My name is Tom McInnes. I'm extremely grateful to be asked on this podcast, despite having no achievements to speak of.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Fuck you.
Fuck you. Goodbye.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZarolineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com. gavinthemahood.com/closer to get started.